cell phones. Do not bring any beverages or food into the church. Refreshments must remain in the Duke Room. Hi, my name is Maureen, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlanta Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Jackie and Debbie, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Diane will read the preamble.
I'm Diane. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problems and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Okay, Chris will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Chris. I'm an alcoholic. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Step seven, humbly asked God to remove our shortcomings. Step eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Step nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Step 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. As we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs.
Sarah will read the tradition.
Hi, I'm Sarah. I'm an alcoholic. Every time I wear a white suit jacket, I'm called to come up here. So if anybody's eager, this strategy might work for you as well. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Jim.
Good evening. My name is Jim, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Jim.
And it is an honor and a privilege to speak at my new home group, the Atlantic Group. If you're new, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous, and if your problem is alcoholism, you truly are in the right place. I would like to thank James for asking me to do this. Thank you, James, and Peggy always for being so welcoming. I have been sober since March 12th of 1988. I came here. I had no tools for living. I had spent my whole life sort of isolating and feeling uncomfortable, unwanted, and sort of uninvited. It wasn't until I had my first drink, truly, that I felt at ease. I felt one with the world, and I felt like I was in the right place at the right time. My poor family had to suffer through a lot of this, because I was, as they were trying to be as kind as they could to me, I was out hunting for a new family, someone that had better furniture at least, you know. I was very self-obsessed. I remember thinking, how do these people have friends? How does that happen? How do people get together, you know? But I was always in my room reading, pursuing my dream of just a fantasy, you know, just fantasy. That's what I loved reading, and I loved being anywhere but where I was. I got good grades. You know, when you do nothing else, you get good grades, you know. I was truly not popular in school because no one really knew me, and I really took quite offense to that. I'm going to fast forward this to college, all right? I was accepted at a good art school called Art Center College of Design, and I did well there. I had not drank. I was 21 years old, about to graduate, and I was at a party, and someone walked up to me and said, "Here, it looks like you could use this." And I took it, and I sort of drank it down and the whole thing, and I said, "Oh, this is pretty good." And I did not know what it was. You know, I went over, and I sort of looked at this bottle, and it was a half gallon, and it was called Royal Occasion Vin Rosé. And I'll tell you that, you know, I was pretty poor as an art student, the whole thing. But within a couple of days, I had a couple of those in my refrigerator. You know, if I had to give up eating, so be it. And I had only been drinking for a week, and I turned 21, I got friends, you know, because alcohol just, whatever barrier I had was lifted. It made great friends. The only thing is that I didn't know when to stop. I did not know, you know. I had gotten my dreams. I worked for an architectural firm. I did well with them. But, you know, in the evenings, I like to drink, and I like to go dance. I remember going my first time to a place called Studio One, and you go up in an elevator because it was an old factory. And when the doors opened, there was lights, people dancing, laughter. I knew I was home. And, you know, the only reason that I stopped going is they closed it. I went to that place 15 years. I don't know what happened to those people, but anyway, I wanted it to continue that way. I wanted it to be just one wonderful party after another. Unfortunately, I was getting older, and I couldn't really maintain going to work. So I told my boss that I was only able to work from 11 to 4. And because he thought I had another job. Normal people think things like that. They don't really question you. You know, they don't really say, well, why can't you work after 4 o'clock? And I didn't want to tell him because I start shaking. I start shaking and sweating. And I was an architectural draftsman. And it's not really a good combination. I continued dancing as long as I could and the whole thing. But towards the end there, I knew I was going to have to give it up. My family had not seen me for years. You know, I would make appointments to see them and, you know, not show up. I couldn't stop it. I could not stop drinking. Nor did I try. You know, I thought once I had started this, you know, that was going to be enough. My big decision, what should I do about this? You know, I didn't go to anyone. I didn't ask them, you know, how do you stop drinking? I knew that I was going to have to, I decided to attempt suicide. So the day after Christmas, 1987, I took something, this is hearsay too. I took about 40 Blue Valium and thought, I had solved my own problem, and the next thing I woke up and I was on a gurney in a dark hallway, and I thought I had gone to hell, you know? And I couldn't move, you know? I'm trying to see what's going on in the whole thing. Finally, somebody came down the hallway, and I said, oh, excuse me, could you untie me? And they said, No, we can't. You've done enough, and please let us take care of you. And I had wanted to hear that all my life. You know, it was there that I had my spiritual awakening. You know, when you're in a lockdown ward, they don't let you shave alone. Somebody stands behind you while you're shaving. And I realized that I had done this myself. No one had forced me to drink. No one had forced me to do anything else. You know, no one had forced me to have a bad relationship with my family and to abandon everyone. I knew it was me. And I said, dear God, please help me. And I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of God, in my opinion, answering that prayer. I was taken to my first meeting. And I did not think that this was going to help me. I did not know what my problem was, but I did not think this was going to help at all. A man got up and said that he had been sober for 30 years. And I said to myself, why would anybody want to be sober for 30 years, you know? But I did hear his story, and I related a lot to him, you know, that he had also been lost and had, you know, had ruined his relationship with his family. Did not know where he was going, but wherever he was, that was not where he wanted to be. And I was thrilled to hear that. You know, afterwards, after the meeting, I saw that everyone had turned to him and thanked him. And I think it was how you treated that speaker that allowed me to come here to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got my sponsor, who I said one day to him, and he says, I don't see you really helping anyone, Jim. Why is that? And I says, well, I'm waiting till I feel better to help others. Never say that, by the way, at least not here. And he said, well, we're going to see about that. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm 39 years old. I mean, what can this man show me? I mean, I'm successful in the whole thing. And he said, well, we'll put all that aside, Jim. You suffer from a hopeless state of mind and body. And basically, we're here to show you how to live day by day in the moment and to be of service to others, which is an incredible concept, you know, for me. If it were not for Alcoholics Anonymous, I would not have the life that I have today. I told you I recently moved here from Los Angeles, and it took me almost 18 years to even get my finances together to move here. You know, I mean, and I had to have a plan. When I told my sponsor I was moving here, he laid out a 9-step plan for me that I, as I finished it off, and the first one was find a home group. You know, that was the first thing. And the next one's find a job and then find a place to live and, you know, and all of this, you know. But he really had this correct. You know, I came here, and as a result of Peggy saying something to me at the Pacific Group, she said, we have one space available and it's and we'll save it for you. I needed to hear that. Thank you.
Thank you. Our second 10-minute speaker is Heather.
Wow. Hi, I'm Heather. I'm an alcoholic. Oh my God, I'm either going to pee my pants or puke. Wow. Well, my sobriety date is November 10th, 2004. My sponsor is Stephanie. And I'm working step 9 and 10, hopefully get to 11 and 12 soon. And okay, so start from the beginning, I guess. I love to drink. I love to drink. One of the first memories that I have of drinking is drinking a Heineken with my dad when I was about 9 at a block party. And he had told me ever so coyly that nobody will never know how much you drink if you always have a bottle in your hand. And I remember that and soon came to be 2 bottles in my hand at the same time, double fisting. It's fabulous. For me anyway, for this alcoholic, I always felt so insecure and so uncomfortable and didn't know how to fit. I didn't know how to fit in. I didn't know how to do it. And try as I might, it just never really worked out for me. But the moment I had that drink, it was... I feel so good. Now I can do anything. I can do anything. I can do anything I want to do. I remember a few months ago going out to Long Island with my sponsor and her sponsor and 2 other people to hear speakers at this big Sunday brunch thing. And this man was speaking, and he was saying that he would be practicing his Academy Award speech in his underwear, drunk. And I'm like, wow, I can relate to that. I can totally relate to that because I did it many a time. And I guess, you know, it's a mixture of everything. And another woman at Pacific Group had said that you really start to learn your story when you come into the rooms and when you get sober. And I'm just learning my story. I was hanging out with a friend of mine last night who was like, do you remember that time? Of course you don't remember that time. Well, let me tell you. And some of the stories are funny. A lot of times are heartbreaking. My mom had told me over this past summer, reminding me how I got so incredibly drunk at my brother's wedding, and I ruined her dance with my brother. And that was like a shining spotlight moment for her. And I just got out on the dance floor with my dad and proceeded to just ruin that special moment for them. And that just broke my heart. Taking responsibility is not something that I'm very fond of. And one thing that I've learned to do since I've gotten sober is taking responsibility. And one of my favorite things that I think I've probably ever read, and I'm an avid reader, is in the 12 and 12, 11th step, about self-forgetting. Since I've gotten sober, it has been such a beautiful journey to forget myself and to be of service to others. Because that's all I really ever wanted to do. You know, I wanted to help. It made me feel good to help. It made me feel good to be of service. and I'm an actor, so in my field, obviously, there's a lot of egoism and just selfishness to the nth degree and grandiosity and thinking that you're better than and thinking you're superior and all those wonderful, fabulous character defects that we know and love and have. And, you know, I would look at all of these other actors that were in my age bracket, and I'd be like, I don't understand why they're directing, and they're producing, and they're doing all this stuff, and what am I doing? I'm doing nothing. I'm doing nothing. It's not fair. And meanwhile, here I am sitting on my butt. I'm sitting on my butt not doing a thing. I'm just getting drunk in my apartment and feeling so sorry for myself. I'm just going to cut to last September. I'm doing a film down in New Mexico. I tried to stay dry a year prior, and I was white-knuckling it. Like, I'm not going to drink. Kathy Griffith, like, in her D-list comedy special, says that you can always tell when an alcoholic's in the room, because they're like, nope, none for me. I'm not drinking. Not me. It's okay. And that was me. That was me. I mean, I remember being at parties while I was driving, like, nope, none for me. I'm okay. Just fidgety and crazy. Just so uncomfortable, restless, irritable, and discontent. So, at the end of the film, and I'd completely dove off the wagon. Forget fallen, forget jumped, dove headfirst into a sea of tequila. And you know, the day I left, they talk about God breaking your spirit and humbling you. I'm not even going to try and explain what it physically and emotionally is to be broken, and I'm sure a lot of you understand exactly what I'm saying, because we've all had that moment of being broken and being humbled, and I knew that I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't do it anymore, and I'm young. I'm only 23, you know, and I remember going home. And Christ Church, this is where I used to go to church, and I would see Atlantic Group, AA, Tuesdays and Thursdays, 7 p.m. And I knew exactly where to go. I knew exactly where to go. And I got home, and I came here, and I went to my first meeting, and I sat in the back, and I had a Bob Marley sweatshirt on and jeans, and my hair was in my face. And all these women flocked to me, and they were like, here's my number. And I was just like, oh, don't. I was repulsed. I had such self-loathing. Like, don't talk to me. Don't, please. I just need to be by myself, when truthfully, I was so desperate. I was so desperate for that human connection, for that true spiritual human connection that is just based in love and honesty and compassion. And I started going to meetings, and I fell in love. I fell in love with the Atlanta group, and I fell in love with all of you. And, you know, I got a sponsor, worked steps, and then through a series of events, got another sponsor, my current sponsor. And it was, you know, they talk about, they're just pointers. They're like, here's suggestions. And I was like, give them to me. I'm a sponge. I just want to absorb every single thing that you have to offer me. I want. I will not question. I will not be like, but wait, no. Okay, you tell me to do this, I'll do it. I don't care. And I don't like being told what to do. But I wanted what all of you had. Tom, who's another person that's a member of this group, had said that his thought of God, that he sees God in all of us, and I see God in all of you. And there's this beautiful light that just shines from each and every one of you, you know. And to the newcomer, whoever you are, I was in your seat. We've all been there. And stay. It's wonderful. It's amazing. It's incredible. It really is. It's like getting the biggest, warmest hug every single day for the rest of your life. It really is Christmas every day. You know, and even on your worst day, it could not match. Like, my worst day in sobriety could not match my best day not sober. It really couldn't. There's nothing else like it. There's nothing else like it. I'm in love. And thank you guys so much.
Bulletin board. And our main speaker for tonight is our chairman, Stacy.
My name is Stacy, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. My God. Hi, Peggy. Okay. This is far worse when it's your home group. My sobriety date is October 18, 1987. My sponsor is Van, and he told me to tell you all hello this evening. Said I could get $10 if I mention his name 3 times, so I'm a third of the way there. And, you know, it was funny. I was thinking about... I'm going to tell you guys something tonight that I haven't shared. My sponsor knows this story, but not many people know it. And for some reason, I think it's compelling and it should be told. And it has to do with long-term sobriety. And so I've got a few years, and I remember when I first got here, they told me, you know, you're going to meetings and you're being of service is kind of like putting money in the bank. And when you do that, there's going to come a day when you're going to go through things that you're really going to need those things they taught you in the beginning. And sometimes, you know, that tough love that your sponsor's saying, do this and do that, and you're thinking, I don't want to do this, you know. Why do I have to? I want to watch TV tonight. I don't feel like going. And there's all of these things that don't make sense in the beginning, but there comes that moment that it all clicks in. So here goes. Back in 2000, I was living downtown, and I left this company I was working at and started my own company, opened it up. You know, the program was being really good to me, and my life was full, and I started my own business, and I'm my own CEO, and that's kind of getting going, and I raise money for it, and things were doing good, and I'm on the cover of magazines and stuff, and I happened to live down in Battery Park City. And I lived right on Chambers. And you know, I'm talking to my sponsor every day. I've come to the Atlantic Group. I'd moved out from Los Angeles, and things are great, and I had a little commitment here. And we all know what happened the morning on September 11th. And my apartment building was a block and a half away. And so I was one of those people who couldn't get home and got evacuated and all this other stuff. And what was odd is I was in the middle of raising money for my company. We had raised a certain amount, but we needed to raise more money. And on September 12th, I had a meeting in Tower 2 on the 95th floor at 8 a.m. the next day. Because we were going to meet with, it wasn't Morgan Stanley, but it was one of the financial companies that wanted to represent us. So that was like the first thing. And the next thing that happened, Marianne and I were, my wife, we were trying to start a family and get pregnant, and we had gotten pregnant and things were going really good, and we lost the baby. And that was maybe 2 months later. And some friends, because we couldn't use my apartment in Battery Park City, some friends in Long Island let us borrow the house. And so I was basically commuting into the city, and she was staying out there. And we decided we were going to buy this house. So I'm kind of out of my mind. And we were at the minute the September 11th happened, you couldn't raise any money, right? And so I'm kind of commuting, and she's staying out there. And you guys all remember how bad the air was down there, and all of my stuff is in the apartment, and it took weeks and before I could move out or do anything. And it took them a few weeks before they declared that it was even secure to go back in there. And we lost the baby, and we almost lost her. And she had this ectopic where she lost a lot of blood, and they didn't think she was going to make it. And then after all of this is going on, we're out, and she's recovering and convalescing, and we're out. And I left the gate open, and one of the dogs got out and got to the highway and got hit by a car. I mean, every month something was happening, right? And I went on the road, still trying to raise the money that I did, and I went on the road, and Van went into the hospital and was having a very simple procedure done. So I'm gone for about 3 or 4 weeks, and I come back, and I went from seeing Van on Tuesday night to seeing this guy with tubes sticking all out of him. And we none of us thought Van was really going to make it. And my company, we couldn't raise money, and it stalled. And so then it started to fall apart. And people started to leave, and everything wasn't working out. And the whole thing, the bottom just fell out of the whole thing. And my office was right around the corner. And right as the bottom is falling out of the whole thing, you guys voted me to chair the Thursday night meeting. And I remember saying to Van, "Van, I can't do this. My life is falling apart. I don't have anything to share. What am I going to talk about every freaking week? I don't have anything to say." I said, "What, am I supposed to share experience, strength, and hope right now? Because I don't have very much." And he said, "Well, you're going to do what we taught you here in AA. You're going to show up no matter what." So I'm showing up, and the bottom's falling out of the company, and everything's going to hell in a handbasket, and the company starts to slide, and I now owe 7 figures. It's 7 figures in debt. And I don't know how I'm going to get out. And I shut the doors. There's no more employees. There's nothing. And all of a sudden, the creditors, some of that debt, the creditors started coming after me in the tune of 6 figures. And they started taking me to court. And I started being down in court all the time. And this was horrendous. And, you know, I'm getting the deliveries at my house, the deliveries at the office, the people coming up saying, "You've been served," you know, like I'm a convict. And it was completely insane. And I just could not get it. My life had become comical because it was just so bad. I couldn't believe it. So all of this stuff is going on. I'm going to court. And I remember I would call Van in his state. And I remember calling Van on the doorsteps of that courthouse every time I had to walk in there. And every time I had to stand in front of a judge. And every time, you know, you basically have to go in. And if you haven't gone through this, you have to go in there and basically declare what has happened. And they really are looking for a person from an officer of the company to come and say, tell us what happened, because the creditors need to know, and they'll write it off or do whatever, but someone's got to be accountable. So I'm doing the Thursday, and now the company can't pay me, but we still have enough momentum that we might be able to pull it out. And one of the big entertainment companies was my backer, and we were going through all of this stuff that I won't get into, but they were committing to put more money in at some point if we could achieve some certain hurdles. So I'm now not even getting paid, and it went a year, and then it went and slid longer, and it was really bad. You know, it really got bad. And I want to tell you, this is what I never admitted, but Van knows this. And this was the thing, I don't know why it was in my stomach tonight. There were weeks when I walked to this meeting from downtown, when I was chairing, because I couldn't afford to get here. And we were taking all of the money we had, because we're trying to start a family. We were taking all the money we had and trying to throw it in there to be able to get the opportunity to be able to do that, because our options were reduced, you know. And I remember having so many sponsees and getting so many phone calls and getting so much love, but they didn't know what they were doing. They thought I was helping them, right? And so one of the things, like one sponsee was going through a really rough time, and he started coming to the office every day, you know, because he was having a tough time staying sober. Has no idea how bad my life was. And here's this person putting my life, showing up every day. Now, I got to act as if I go in there and I'm scared to pick up my phone, because I don't, there is nobody calling me who's friendly. Nobody. You know how when remember when you came into the program and you used to just not open your mail, and all your mail had like the final notice and the red stripe on it. And you think, well, I'm sober, I'm showing up, I'm a nice guy, I'm a service. This isn't supposed to be happening to me. Why is this stuff happening to me? And so all of that was happening in sobriety to me. And I just started showing up, and so it was really amazing to me, sitting right there in that seat and upstairs, and that basket would come, and I had walked. And I remember taking my coat off and my vest, because I had to wear, and you're walking up in the summertime all the way from downtown, and you can't put nothing in the basket. And there were times where my wife and I were rolling coins in sobriety. And so we kept showing up. And I stuck to the power of Van. Van was so inspirational to me, because this guy would be on the other end of the phone no matter what. And when he was getting a rib removed, or, you know, something else was happening to him, he was in the hospital and he was answering the phone. And I kept saying, if he can do it, I can do it. If he can answer that phone, I can go another day. I can show up tomorrow. And I just show up. And that's all he would say, is just show up tomorrow, it'll all work out. He kept saying, you know, why does it always rain when the rain dancers pray for rain? Because they dance until it rains. And back in March, I think it was, we had been having these failed IVF attempts. And if any of you have gone through this, it's a lot of money. You flush your money down the toilet, and they go, too bad, wait in a month and come back and see us. And we went again and threw everything we had at it, and it took. And Jeannie and Marianne are actually a day apart, but we're due January 21st. And, well, thank you. And the how am I doing on time? Okay. The thing that was so remarkable was there were things that I learned in the very beginning. So let me give you the full picture. So baby department, good to go. Company, you know, we settled a lot of those things. We staved off a lot of stuff with the creditors. We stabilized everything. Good to go. New company in the works, out raising money for that. You know, it was like, and then what happened was my relationship with AA, my relationship with my sponsor, my relationship with my sponsees, my relationship with my wife, all of them got stronger and better and faster and bigger, you know. And I got what the old timers said. It's like when you come here and you're in boot camp. And they're yelling at you, and they're screaming at you. And I listen, I'm going to tell you how my early sponsorship was, and even how Van is to me sometimes today. He doesn't admit this, but I'm going to tell you the story. He always says this isn't what happened, but I have the emotional scars to prove it. One day I'm over at an editing studio, and I get some editing time, and I call up Van, and it's about an hour or two before the meeting, and I said, "Hey, Van, it's Stace. I just wanted to call and check in. I got some editing time, and I'm not going to be able to make it to the meeting tonight, but I just wanted to let you know." And there's kind of this pause on the other end, and Van says to me, "The next time you want a drink, call an editor." And he hangs up the phone. I swear to God, he denies it, but I remember it. So I went ahead... And I told the editing studio, "I'll be right back." I went over to the meeting, and I was in the meeting, and I walked in. He said, "I'm glad you could make it." And I sat there, and after the meeting, I went back to the studio. They were still loading in the sound cards and weren't even ready for us to start editing yet, you know? So I would have been sitting there doing absolutely nothing. And, you know, he told me, put AA first. Always put your program first. It'll pull you through anything. It'll pull you through everything, you know. And in the beginning, I got sober on the West Coast. I actually got sober in Brentwood. And I went to a lot of West Hollywood meetings. And these guys were tough. They were tough on you. You know, they crosstalk. They'd be if I was up here whining about something, they'd sit in the front row and say, "Would you like some cheese with that wine you're having up there?" You know, they were the types who they would sit there in the front row and they'd bet on how long you'll stay sober. You know, they'd lean over at each other and go, 60 days tops." And somebody else would go, "I don't give him 50. And, you know, I remember getting a chip and looking at those guys going, "Ha-ha." Like, you know, it was like I was going to stay sober despite them. And it was they knew what they were doing. It's like give an alcoholic a resentment. Tell them they can't do something, you know, and they'll stay sober just because. And they gave us tough love. They didn't care about our feelings. They would say, "Sit down, shut up, put the cotton out of your ears and your mouth. You don't have anything to say for your first 5 years." And I'd go, "What do you mean? You know, my feelings." I get the sense of humor now, you know, after so much time. I understand it and I get it and I appreciate it. And these guys really loved you and wanted to see you survive. And the thing that I got was, if they didn't walk me through that, there is no way I would have made it through the last 5 years. No way. And a lot of these guys, my first sponsor passed away this year, Eli from the West Coast. And those guys, you remember Eli, Peggy? Those guys, many of them are dead. But I'm here, and I'm alive. And everybody who I got sober with, there are very few people from my sobriety. I go back every year and I stand up in L.A. at my old home group just to check in and let them know I'm still breathing. But there's a lot of people who, they're not here, you know. And when I got here, they said, buy a black suit because you're going to go to funerals, you know. We bury people here who think they can do it their way, you know. I've buried sponsees right here. And that's the truth. And so I'm really incredibly grateful for that tough love that I got. And having chaired Thursday, we get a lot of whining in that basket. I don't like my sponsor. My sponsor's mean to me. My sponsor doesn't treat me right. I don't know if I should keep my sponsor. I want to fire my sponsor. My sponsor doesn't like me. Should I let go of my sponsor if my sponsor doesn't return my phone calls every 30 minutes? Blah, 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 blah. And it cracks me up because I think, oh, my God, you know. Those old-timers would have a field day with that asket basket. And I see Peggy and Vince practice great restraint of pen and tongue at it. But it is... So I want to spend the last few minutes talking to the newcomer. And I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to welcome you to... you stumbled into the greatest thing for you. Your life is going to be beyond your wildest dreams. Now, when I got here, my vision of that was cash and prizes. You know, I loved hearing the circuit speakers that would get up and say, you see that car outside, that big Cadillac's mine, that beautiful wife is mine, that building down the street I own is mine, and that's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I loved hearing speakers like that. And what I hated was, I hated the speakers that would get up in front of the room and go, everything is happening to me, my life is miserable, and I have 20 years. Good luck. You know, those were the speakers I was just like, where do I slip my wrist now? Because I do not want what you have. So when I first got here, it was like, it was all about cash and prizes. It was like, I wanted to be hip, slick, and cool. I wanted what you had. When I came to AA, I got here, and I went to my first meeting, and getting sober in LA, you know, I read the papers, I read the tabloids. See, I'm going to come to AA, and I'm either going to have Robert De Niro or Clint Eastwood as my sponsor, and you know, Clint Eastwood's going to come, and I'm not saying that they're sober, I'm just using them fictitiously, because there's some newcomer going, they're sober? But I, you know, I'm going to meetings in Hollywood, and I know Clint's going to be at the front of a room, and I'm going to go up and say, will you be my sponsor? And he says, do you want to get sober, punk? You know? Are you willing to go to any lengths? Bring your big book. And this was my idea of what Alcoholics Anonymous was going to be. And I got there, and Eli, I was at my first meeting outside of the detox, and Eli taps me on the shoulder. I stood up in the front row, and I said, I'm Stacy, I'm a grateful alcoholic, and I have to get a sponsor tonight, and I can't leave without one. And I'll take anybody. I need a sponsor. And I sat back down, and I get a tap on my shoulder, and I turn around, and I get a little piece of paper that says, Eli, phone number, I will help you. And I turn around, and I know it's really Clint, but it's this little guy named Eli who looks like Albert Einstein with little hair on the side, and he's like... And this is not quite what I had in mind, but he's a little old man, I feel sorry for him, so I'm going to go hang out with him, right? So... Eli comes up to me at the end of the meeting, and he says, hi, I'm Eli. It's such a pleasure to meet you. And listen, so we're going to get into the big book, and meet me at the Early World Diner tomorrow, and bring your big book. Okay, see you next. Oh, and call me every day. And so the next day, I'm in this diner, and I start going through the big book with Eli, and I'm going, I'd read a page, he reads a page. He reads a page, I read a page, and we get up to my fourth step. Now, I know... Eli's not going to have me read my inventory in a diner. So I'm waiting as he's telling me what to do and when we're going to meet about my fourth step. And he says, you got 2 weeks, meet me back here in the Early World Diner, 7 o'clock on Thursday. Okay. Now, Eli's a little older. Eli got sober the year I was born. And Eli has a hearing aid. So I've got this fourth step. And this is a big deal to me. You know, you've all, well, mostly all of you, some of you, have done your fourth step. And you know what a precious moment this is, right? This is your deepest, darkest, greatest secrets. You just know the minute you say these, they're going to come and arrest you. They're going to drag you out. And I start. And I lean in and I'd say, I slept with my cousin. And he'd say, you slept with who? I'd say, I slept with my cousin. He'd say, oh, you slept with your cousin. Oh, okay, go ahead, keep going. And the whole fourth step was Eli repeating back my fourth step to me. I'm like, this is crazy. And I know everybody in the booths around me here, it's 6 o'clock in the evening. It's rush hour in this diner. Finally, I don't care. They know everything. I don't care. And I do my inventory with Eli. And he was so funny that way. And I would get these panics. How much time I got? Okay. I get these big panics. And the worst thing has just happened. Eli, I came into the office. And I was sitting at my desk. And my boss walks in. And he didn't say hello. And I'd say, that means I'm getting fired. I know it. That means I'm getting fired. And I'd call him and he'd say, okay, what meeting are you going to tonight? And I'd name some meeting and he'd say, good, when you go there tonight, I want you to grab a broom and I want you to clean up. And I'd say, yeah, but I'm about to get fired. He goes, I heard you. Go to the meeting tonight. Go and talk about it and let me know. I'll be there. And he wouldn't show up. So I'd be dating or something else would happen and I'd say, she's breaking up with me, she's sleeping with somebody else, I know it. And he'd say, okay, well, in LA, some of the meetings have this thing, they call it, if you need a ride, some of the meetings you could raise your hand if you needed a ride and people would offer you a ride. Eli always made me raise my hand and volunteer to drive somebody. And I'd always get somebody in Orange County and somebody in San Fernando Valley. And I'm thinking, why are you going to a meeting over here when there's a meeting near your house? But somehow I got to drive 2 hours there and back. And I get these guys who got 5 days and they'd, me, 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 me. And I'd get a dose of myself of what I sounded like. And so I started sponsoring people and I just did what Eli said. If Eli said push a ball down the hall with your nose, I would do it. I was just terrified that I didn't want to get drunk, you know. And I did everything that they said. Those old timers, they just scared the living daylights out of me. When they said buy a black suit because you're going to go to funerals, if not, buy a black suit so we know what to bury you in, they freaked me out, you know. And I was terrified to walk down the aisle in the grocery store that had alcohol. I was just terrified. I believe I would just be struck drunk because I had no ability to not drink. You know, I understood very clearly the idea of the first step in being powerless. And a day at a time, I did what I was taught. You know, I did what I was told. I went to any lengths. Eli told me the greatest gem I will tell you, and this is what has gotten me to 18 plus years. If you're willing to work half as hard at staying sober as you did getting high, you will never have a problem staying sober. You could call me at 3 o'clock in the morning and say there's a party starting and I got to be to work at 6. I will get out of my bed, go to the party at 3 o'clock and don't show up to work for a week. Oh, I'm sick. I got the flu. You know, I would go to any length to drink and party. And I was grateful that I was willing to go to any length to get to an AA meeting. I was willing to walk if I had to. You know, on September 11th, a lot of you showed up. You know, you had a meeting here. You know, when we had the fire, we had a meeting here. You know, during transit strikes, there were meetings. It's like there's no matter what, you don't let your disease have an inch. Success is measured in inches, not miles. You know, it's just that one day I can do anything with you. There's not a person in this room that won't stand up for you. Look around you as 300 people, make sure you won't pick up. You got no reason, except I want to. You know, when I get a resentment and I don't like what God's dealing me and I don't want to play anymore, that's when I'm in trouble. Because what I just told you, there's somebody, and I believe this, there's somebody tonight that maybe if they didn't hear that, they wouldn't have kept going. They wouldn't have went that one more step. They wouldn't have shown up another day till the tide turns. The tide always comes around. The tide always rises again. You never give up. You never quit. Because if you do, you're doomed. AA, people say there's a 50% success rate in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a 100% success rate for people who don't drink. It's not that it works 50% of the time. If you do the first step, it's a 100% success rate. And so I love when Winston Churchill, 50% of London is bombed. Now think about it, not two buildings. 50% of London is bombed. And he sends out a radio address. And he says, we will never, 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 never surrender. We will fight on the land. We will fight in the sea. We will fight in the skies. We will fight in the streets. We will never quit. And he let out a battle cry for those people in such a distressed moment that helped pull them through. And he said, let them look back 1,000 years from now and say that this was our greatest hour. I love that. That to me is the anthem of Alcoholics Anonymous and what it means to show up a day at a time to fight the good fight. And so you look at me and you voted me to be your chair at the worst time in my entire life. When nothing looked right, nothing looked good. There was no way to get through what I was going through. And you wanted what I had, and you wanted me to show up a day at a time. And then the freaking big meeting wants me to speak. For what? I was going through hell. And Van's like, show up. And if Van wasn't showing up, I might not have showed up. If Peggy wasn't showing up, if all of you weren't showing up, you know? And that is the message. AA works perfect. It's me who quits. It's me who lets go of the bar. It's me who's not willing to show up tomorrow. It's me who says, I can't. Just take that tea off and throw it in the trash and show up. Thank you for letting me be of service. Thank you for this year. Thank you for getting me through everything. Never give up. Never surrender. And always fight the good fight. Thank you.